Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil. I am a council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is nestled between Norristown and King of Prussia. And if you don't know those places, it is near Philadelphia. And if you don't know Philadelphia, then we have a bigger problem. I am excited to bring you conversations with people who have run for office, who are running for office, to give you, the listener, some ideas about what it's like to run, why people run for office, and the challenges of doing so. And hopefully you will listen and take it upon yourself to become a candidate yourself, whether it's for Congress, as some of the people we've met with, talked with, have done, and including my guest today, and or it's for school board, which a number of people have done on this podcast as well. So every office matters. There's over 500,000 elected offices in this country. And encourage you to learn about the ones in your area. Or if you want to learn about candidates across the country, I definitely recommend a place called runforsomething.net, where you can learn about some of the tools you can use to run. For today, though, if you've listened, you know I've been trying to talk to people all across the country. And finally, I get to talk to someone from Florida. I'm very excited. And of course, it's someone from Florida who's the first person that talks about her sumo experience. And her boxing experience. So she's going to be a really awesome character and an awesome candidate for Congress, Cindy Banier. Thank you for joining the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I was looking up your profile, and I'll be honest, I don't follow a lot of Florida congressional races. But you have quite the interesting background, and now you're running for Congress for the first time, right?
Yeah, this is the first time I've run for office of any kind, actually, so let alone Congress in Florida.
But it might be the first time you've run for office, but I know from some of the pictures and things, you have been interested in government, good government, and politics, right, for a while?
Oh, yeah. I am by no means a newbie to the political arena. I just never have run for office. I've been more of a behind-the-scenes type of person. I have worked for governments in a consulting capacity, doing technical assistance and evaluation and policy design for the Japanese government, actually. We helped government officials from over 25 countries around the world help to design policy that's efficient and effective. In the United States, I've worked mostly in the nonprofit world, helping them meet their goals and serve our communities better. And I'm also on faculty in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at Florida Gulf Coast University.
It's a really interesting background. What brought you to Japan? You've lived in Florida your whole life. You're a Floridian by default, right?
Yes, I say that I am the mother to three native Floridians. But my early life started in undergraduate in international relations at Michigan State. Mm-hmm. That's actually also where I had some additional experience in politics. I interned for two senators, both Democrats and Republicans, as I was doing my undergraduate studies. But having studied international relations, I really wanted to move abroad and check it out. So I moved and I taught English in Taiwan for 3 years, and then I decided to pursue my graduate studies in Japan.
I mean, it sounds just 3 minutes in, and I'm interested in like just learning all about you, and I don't have that much time. But so you intern. What years did you intern for senators?
So I first was a personal office intern for Senator Spencer Abraham, mm-hmm. Which is your first big toe into politics on Capitol Hill, which is answering phones, talking to constituents, sorting mail, doing Capitol tours, and that was a fantastic experience. I made a lot of close acquaintances and friends to this day. Spence Abraham actually then went on to be appointed to Secretary of Energy and under George W. Bush. So that was a good experience, and I loved it. And that was in 1999. And then in the year 2000, I loved it so much. I went to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan out of New York. His committee office for the Senate Finance Committee, and I worked with the team there on the trade staff, so really focusing on compiling research and preparing for floor debate on the U.S.-China Permanent Normal Trade Relations Bill, which was the bill that allowed China to ascend to the WTO. So that was a great time there, and so one Republican, one Democrat, and I kind of, that was my first foray into being somebody who really was interested in bridging the partisan divide.
And you weren't working for backbencher politicians, people who are just there to collect a paycheck. Those are two big names that have left an impact to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Dana Patrick Moynihan is considered the father of evaluation, which is so funny how my career path has taken. I'm an evaluator kind of by my practice and my field in consulting and nonprofit management. And his bill in the 70s that kind of was a first foray into let's study poverty, let's study poverty programming, is considered one of the quintessential pieces of legislation in the United States around developing the culture of evaluation within our policy structures. And so he ended up being a massive role model to me, and was also a fantastic man and a person to interact with in my early 20s. Really was kind to everyone in his office, and even, you know, as a young person at the beginning of their career, always reached out and made time to connect with me. So I was very fortunate to have those experiences.
So those experiences you had in government and then abroad, has that kind of sparked your, I don't even want to say your interest, but your kind of energy and maybe even anger to inspire you to run for office today? Because, you know, you're working with people who I don't think anyone would call Spencer Abraham or Dana Patrick Moynihan, you know, bonkers or lightweights. And you see what's going on now and you're like, this isn't what you remember from back then, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I really was kind of acculturated to Capitol Hill life in the era of bipartisanship. If you said to somebody at that time in the early 2000s that you were not acting in a bipartisan way, that was a slam. You know, you need to go ahead and you need to work together with people across the aisle to figure things out. And that was the way that things got done, and it has been the way that things have gotten done in our history of our legislature. And it really does pain me to come to this point where we are so divided, where the partisanness of everything divides us even further. Our rhetoric divides us because people themselves are not that far apart when it comes right down to it. And we should expect more out of our politicians and elected officials to act in a way that's in all of our best interest.
Now, yeah, it was maybe more bipartisan then, but 1999 was also the year that, you know, Bill Clinton just ended his impeachment. And I don't want to get into impeachment. That's not why you're running for office, probably. But you are running for Congress now in a very, you know, historic time. Things are not what we expected. And you're going to, if you win, which you're running to win, of course.
Absolutely.
You have a lot on your shoulders as a potential member of Congress.
Yeah, but I think that when I look back at it, this has been something that I've been working to get the right experience and the right knowledge my whole life. I've wanted to be somebody who made a difference in our world and in our community, and it is the reason I studied what I did. It is the reason why I worked for whom I worked for. It is the reason that I went abroad. It is the reason that I got a master's and a PhD in public administration and community development. It's because I think that these things are important for us. And I do want to take these things to Congress, because we've gotten to a point where politicians and partisans are the ones leading the way instead of people who actually know how to craft strong governments and strong communities. And that's where I'm at. I'm ready to step from behind the shadows to the forefront of decision making. I'm at a point in my life where I've been advising organizations and leaders to make good decisions, and truth be told, they've let me down. sometimes. I'm very data-driven. I have an eye on efficiency and results. I have an eye on making sure that the needle moves in major areas that we want to see change in our community. And I'm tired of people playing politics with all of that. And I'm ready to take all of these skills and the things that I've cultivated my whole life and put them out there to make sure that we have a well-functioning government that serves its people.
And I think from listening to you, and especially the kind of background you have, your definition of well-functioning is different than what a lot of other people say on TV. Because, you know, I hear people who are in Congress or are pundits on TV, and they're like, oh, Congress should function well, which really means Congress should pass the things I want to pass. A lot of the time, you know, and I mean, that's how I think sometimes, you know, we all fall into that. But being data driven, as you said, and having the experiences you have, both professionally and personally, which we'll get to, what are the issues that you think you would like to most tackle with that mindset?
Well, for me, the first and foremost issue that is top of mind for me is the environment and climate change. And I align with the SDGs, the global goals, the sustainable development goals. They're the most comprehensive set of collaborative goals and targets we've had in human history, by the way, that really brings people together to make substantial change and kind of aligns all of the work of individuals and organizations and aims them towards big goals that we need to continue to move forward in our world and for our kids. And for us here in Southwest Florida, that's a major issue. Our water, we've had major problems with our water, both our beach water and our river water, because polluters have not been held accountable. We have had massive hurricanes here that are disruptive to us and massively devastating to our economy, and they will only get worse if we keep ignoring climate change. And my daughter, who is 2 years old, has only been to the beach once here as a native Floridian, and that's because the state of our beaches has been so terrible. And also, it's really ruined our economy when we had a whole tourist season where people couldn't come to the beach because there was such massive fish kills because of red tide that you couldn't come within a mile of the shore. So that's kind of the first place that I want to start, and that is aligning our federal policy with the sustainable development goals, making sure that we're acting as a good global steward of our role in the global community as the major economy, as a major democracy. I really want to regain that to make sure that we can continue to have a safe and clean environment moving forward.
I can't imagine that there's any place in the country that is more impacted by climate change than South Florida. The whole, really all of Florida, but especially South Florida. When you look at all of the measurements, and as someone who's data-driven like you, with the background you have, it must drive you bonkers, right? Just like, you just want to pull out the numbers and say, this is what it says. I'm not making this up.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that's been a real big problem for us is that our leadership in the state and at the national level has disavowed that climate change is even happening, basically up until 2 weeks ago, frankly. You couldn't say climate change during the Rick Scott administration as governor here in Florida. And now we're supposed to believe that all of a sudden these politicians that have held seats on petroleum companies and cemented over large swaths of our environment, which, by the way, cement is an incredibly damaging thing to do because it's a heat sink, and the creation of clinker is a matter to pollutants and get greenhouse gases. But with somebody who's made their business on that, their fortune, their billions on that, now we're supposed to believe all of a sudden because the polls show them that 78% of Southwest Floridians believe that climate change is a real problem. Oh, now they care about it. Yeah, I'm really over listening to people who've made their money destroying our environment. I want to see the real change happen, I want to have people in office and in leadership positions that will acknowledge the fact that overdevelopment is an issue. I love the fact that Cape Coral and Fort Myers are one of the most moved to places in the entire United States, but we have such problems with the way that we go about our development that we leave some of the poorest of our communities flooded because of the development. So when we drain one area, the water here in Florida, it goes to another place. I think that we need sensible leadership from top to bottom here on that. And yeah, it does make me want to pull out the figures and say, hey, everybody, let's listen. But I'm also somebody that knows that you gotta start talking to people in a real way. What we really need everybody to understand is this is actually happening. It has been happening, and we need to disempower the people who've made their monies making it happen.
And you know, looking at your background and your reasoning for running, yes, you look at the data for climate change and you know the impact, and you can speak about it better than most. I mean, I know a lot of people who will explain why it's bad but can't get into the details, but you and I both care about climate change on a personal level because we have young kids. And
yeah.
I know that, you know, I'm wondering what's going to happen with my son when he's 20. He's five, my 5 and 3 year old. Like, what's going to happen when they're in their 20s and starting out in life and this is happening? So what's your experience as a mother motivating you and challenging you as a candidate?
Yeah. So, I am really worried about the future that we're leaving our children. I know that the sea level is rising. I know that the hurricanes and fires and flooding is getting worse. And I know that if we don't act now, it will be too late. And it may already be too late, and we may be in mitigation phase, but we need to act. You know, being a mom puts a special perspective on it because I do care what happens to my kids moving forward. And I care about all of our kids too, because I know also that when it comes to climate disasters, the people who are most vulnerable, our seniors, our children, the people without means, are the ones that pay the highest price. They're the ones that cannot leave from flooded areas. They are the ones that cannot evacuate from hurricanes. They are the ones that have the least updated houses, so are most likely to experience property and injury, property damage and injury during massive hurricanes. So I'm worried about all of them because I want stable communities. I want my children to be able to live in a place where they are safe and happy, and that they have neighbors who also can have self-determination in their life. And it's not just, oh, great, look, I have a pile of cash that I can use to get myself through all these horrible events, but down the block, they have nothing. That's the most unstable type of community that we have around the world. And that's really what scares me the most, is that we are not paying attention to the communities. We're not paying attention to what happens in neighborhoods and to all the people that live in places. We're just giving preference to the highest of the high, the elites in the world, and we're letting everybody else slide and just fend for themselves. And trust me when I say that when the climate calamity continues...
Right, continues, not starts, continues.
We will see more skirmishes, more refugees, more fights at local and international levels as people continue to struggle for resources. And we have to take these things seriously. And also, by the way, we have to see the interconnectedness between them. If we don't start to realize that, yeah, guess what? Climate change has an effect on refugees and migrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has an effect on our climate or on our economy. It has an effect on how businesses, how businesses work, has an effect on education, has an effect on trade. And all of these things are really important for us to understand. Systemically. And I know, sorry, I think I went back to the climate change because I really got inspired about that. So maybe you want to ask me a question about specifically being a mom again, and I can talk more about...
No, that's okay. I mean, I think that, you know, before we get to what being a mom, the way you're explaining it, because you're talking about refugees too, and not to get into that issue extensively, but you have experience in Japan, You have experience with these distinguished senators on the Hill, and you have experience working with the UN. Does that color your perspective on these issues? Because you're looking at it more broadly than, well, there's more water.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at FGCU, I teach a class called Global Studies. And really what that is introduction to systems thinking. I'm a systemic thinker, and it has everything to do with the fact that I started my studies with international relations and that I worked for international organizations. And in fact, my UN experience, I serve as the representative for an NGO, a non-governmental organization called the International Association for Community Development. So we advocate for community at the international level. So it's high to low. And I'm very fortunate to have the ability to kind of think plastically like that, being able to think of the broadest level and then how it's connected to the localist of levels. But they are. All actions happen at the local level. And we need international policy and goals and guidance, and the national guidance and regulation as well, to enable local actions. So I think that it's all interconnected to me, and it does have a lot to do with the fact that I have lived and worked abroad. When you do travel to another country and live in another country extensively, like I have a total of almost 8 years of living outside the United States, you learn a couple of things. First of all, you learn a lot about yourself, like who you are, who is your culture, what is your identity. And then you start to realize the parts that are kind of just socially reinforced that are relatively arbitrary, and the parts that are really important to people and all peoples across cultures. That is one reason why I think it's important to think globally and act locally and work all the connections in between, because there are these cross-cutting issues, and the SDGs are a framework that help us understand that to move the entire planet forward.
I think it makes a lot of sense, and I know that Florida is a very diverse area, so having someone who gets those cross-cultural issues when it comes to climate change or healthcare or anything, you know, it definitely helps with formulating policy. But you, like we just said, you're a mom. And I don't want to say as a mom what's hard about running, because I hope you agree. We need to start thinking about as a parent, because it needs to be equally hard for a dad or a mom to do things. And so I don't think it's fair to say, oh, you're battling career and family as a mom, and not say it to dads too. You know, being a mom, is that a motivating factor? Is that a challenge? How's that affect your decision to run and get involved?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be a mom, and I love what you said that, yeah, it's parents, you know, we all think about our kids. You know, there are plenty of people who don't have kids and they think about the future too. So it's not that that's an exclusive kind of thing. But for me, I feel particularly compelled because I do want them to have a good place to live. And I do want them to be able to be successful in their life. I think that, honestly, if I'm really 100% honest, what the biggest challenge of being a mom is answering all the questions that people ask me about being a woman and being a mom and running. So even just very early on in my campaign here, it's like, oh, who's watching your kids? Oh, what about your husband? Oh, who's taking care of them? And it's been very, I was prepared for it, but it's still like a constant battle to get people to realize, like, you know what, this running for office is the same as running my business, and I just figure it out. I call my babysitter, I call my husband, I have help where I need help, I bring my kids with me. I took my kids to New York, to the UN, as much as I could. I have always brought my kids with me. When my youngest was born, I was teaching at FGCU, and she was born on a Thursday. I teach on Thursdays. I canceled, I sent a email to my class. I canceled the class, and I said, don't worry, we're not going to have class today, but I'll be back next week. And lo and behold, next week I was back in front of my class lecturing, baby and sling, rocking and rolling, no sweat. That's what you have to do, frankly, when you're somebody like me who runs their own business, who doesn't have, you know, family medical leave. We have no policy around that at the federal level, let alone for somebody who's a part-time faculty and a you know, independent business owner. I just had to take my kids with me. I just had to figure it out, and we did. But yeah, all of a sudden everybody's super worried about what happens with my kids and where they're going to go and what they're going to do. And I have never seen any of my male counterparts being asked these questions.
No, no one's ever asked me.
They do have kids, though. So.
Yeah. People say, oh, your kids are cute. But they don't. It's a mindset that and I think it's misogynistic both ways. Like, it's assuming that you were the one in charge as a mom. And also assuming, like they say in 80s or 90s TV shows, that the dad is a babysitter sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that's just bad for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's so that's been the hardest part. I mean, figuring out how I'm going to coordinate my life around my campaign is the same as it's been around my business and everything else. So, you know, I think that the biggest factor for me is using their energy and their innocence as children to kind of guide me towards what we need to do as policymakers. You know, let's make the world better for them and all of our kids.
So you're trying to make the better for them and all kids and people who don't have kids, like you said. You're very good at including everybody in every answer. That's admirable in some of these complicated things.
I try.
Better than I would do. But you do live in a tough area. The South, people look at Florida, every statewide race is 50-50, no matter who the candidates are. It's always a so-called swing state, but you live in a very conservative area.
Yeah.
Is that something that obviously hasn't intimidated you?
No. Listen, I, you know, we talked before the show, but, you know, I used to, you know, get punched in the face for fun. So, yeah, looking at how red our district is was not intimidating to me at all, oddly enough. No.
Well, you got punched in the face for fun because you were a boxer.
I was a boxer.
Like, let's put that out there because that just sounds weird in a Florida thing. Like, oh, Florida woman gets punched in the face for fun. Like.
That's right, because I was a boxer, but I chose to do that. So, but yeah, no, it's you know, it's a very conservative district, and there, you know, that was the other thing. You know, the two questions I got asked coming out of the gates here was, "What are you doing with your kids, and why are you trying to run for this seat that has basically been a wash?" You know, no one has thought for years since this seat has been created, essentially gerrymandered into a completely Republican district. No other Democrat has really been able to look at it. While we had some really great candidates in the past that really gave it their a good try, but it's just, it's very, very red. I mean, slanted more than probably any other place. And from what I understand, it's the second most conservative district in the entire state of Florida. So, so why am I not intimidated? I'm going to go back to my bipartisan roots. I have been somebody who's really tried very hard to be inclusive of all sides as much as possible. And that means right and left. I still have friends who are Republican. I have friends that are Democrats. I have friends who are way right. I have friends who are way left. And I try to be conscientious of being able to speak to all of them. You know, I think that there was a big push after the 2016 to everybody just go back to their camps, right? You know, people who were really very liberal were very upset, and they just couldn't hear the people on the right, and the people who were far right were, you know, just ecstatic at the win, and they, you know, they are now have the ability to just ostracize everybody on the left. But I kind of stuck with it, and I talked to people, and in fact, I had the very fortunate opportunity right after the 2016 election to work with a reporter at Gulf Shore Business, which is a magazine here in Southwest Florida, to do a project on bridging the divide here. So we got groups of conservative folks and groups of liberals together, and we talked to them about what kinds of issues are really roiling for them, and then we brought those groups together then and did kind of like cross, you know, partisan dialogues around this to try to bridge the gap and figure it out. And what we learned from that process, and I was the facilitator and the researcher and all that stuff on it, but what we learned from the process was ultimately we all care about our community. We all care about where we came from. We all care about what happens to us and our families. And if we keep the message there, then we can reach more people than going all the way right and all the way left. And so I mean more about like building the relationships with people than I'm talking about policy stances. But if you start reaching out to people that are not in your quote ideological circle, right? And you start engaging them in dialogue, you get a heck of a lot further with people than just staying in your camp. And the way that I look at this district with how red it is, no Democrat is ever going to be able to win by currying favor with only Democrats in this district. You got to reach out to everybody.
And, you know, I was talking with Jill Schiller, who ran for Congress in a very red district in Ohio. I talked with Emily Segrist, who I really admire, who's a nurse who ran for state representative in Wisconsin. And, you know, I really appreciate people running in these tough districts, because if you're someone from Philadelphia, where I live, or New York, or, you know, any sort of more Democratic or liberal area, you're like, why aren't these people in this district in Florida or in Wisconsin or in Ohio? Why don't they understand climate change or healthcare or this thing? You get frustrated. Well, no one like Cindy went to talk to them. There was no one running. So you are there to you might hopefully you win. I mean, I don't make endorsements on the show. Not that it matters. But, you know, you'd love to make those changes. But you can change minds, and that will affect things up and down the ballot this election and potentially for elections to come.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, yeah, you got to get out there and talk to people. And so, I mean, this whole campaign it has to be grassroots. I'm running against a billionaire. I can never outspend him, which is also the fun part about this campaign, is I have to get out and talk to people, and I have to reach across to everybody. And I think that it's important, and that I do hope it sets a precedent. I do hope I win. I think I will if I keep talking to people like I have been throughout my entire career here in Southwest Florida. And, you know, I do hope that it starts to, you know, change the tide to a certain extent. I would love to be the person that goes to Capitol Hill and starts to rebuild some of these fractured relationships that we have, because Congress does ultimately work better for the people if all of the politicians that are elected there work better together. So I hope that I can be part of that change wave, like you said.
And doing so can make some lasting change. People aren't going to run, which is what the purpose, and Joe Biden, if he's the nominee, or Elizabeth Warren, or Bernie Sanders, or, you know, the likely nominee, Marianne Williamson, if they're probably not going to be investing a lot of campaign resources in this district. And I think we saw that in 2016, where there were a lot of congressional races that weren't contested. And they were contested last year, and then they flipped. And so when they're not contested by the presidential campaign, they're, you know, no one else is contesting for those voters. So you can have an impact where whoever the Democratic nominee won't.
Yeah. Nobody's coming down here. I'll tell you that. And, you know, I've even, you know, had, you know, conversations with our local party and our state party. And I just, you know, they're on limited resources too. And so they've kind of said, hey, you know, we'll help you when we can, but we're going to be aiming our resources toward more strategically viable, from our perspective, races. And so, I mean, I kind of, I know that I'm on my own, which is fine, because I've been on my own for a long time, and I think I've done pretty good. So that really doesn't daunt me. And I really do think that once my campaign really gets rolling, by the way, it's only been a few weeks since I've done my filing and gotten my campaign rolling here. But I think once I start rolling, I'll be able to bring some more people to my side once they see what I'm trying to do and what I'm about, and that, you know, I'm not, you know, just, you know, a figure and head, and, you know, I'm not just blowing up. I mean, I was about to say something bad, but, you know, I'm not just blowing sunshine out there.
Right.
And that I really have substance and I really have skills around connecting with people across divides. I really think that's going to bring people closer to me and hopefully bring some additional attention. And really, ultimately, the other thing I'm trying to do is make it so that people don't think Democrat is a dirty word. It's very strange to be running as a Democrat here and kind of just, you know, very initially kind of building my relationships with people and then saying, oh yeah, and I'm a Democrat, you know, and they're like, oh really, wow, that's very surprising. You know, anybody who talks to me long enough can see that my policy very much aligns with you know, very you know, very Democratic campaign, you know, planks. You talk to me for long enough, you can hear all that. But I think it's just, I think people are really, they've got this us mentality and they've put Democrats in the them category. And I'm hoping to change that by building the bridges across this region. Love for our national candidates to come here. I would love to have support from anybody else. But if not today, maybe someday soon.
Yeah, well, you're building something that needs to be built, and I admire you for trying, and that's what we need more people to do. That's why this podcast is called You Should Run. So I've enjoyed a conversation, but before we end, why should other people run for office?
I think everybody for office, if they feel so inclined. It's been a painful thing for me to watch really talented people who work, particularly in like the realm that I work in, the nonprofit sector, the service sector, even our government administration folks, public university folks as well. We feel like it's not something that you do. You know, you feel like it's something that, oh, you just, you know, it's for the other people, or, you know, it's people who are bought and paid for by certain entities. And it kind of leaves the rest of us who are just regular people who want to make a difference in our communities out in the cold. And I think more people, if more regular people ran and more people supported the ordinary candidate, the mom, you know, the lady who works at the store, you know, people who had things that affected them, you know, people who had, you know, sick kids, or people who are really upset about the water. If more of those people step forward to run, we would see the value in them, and we would see that they can make a difference. It doesn't have to be a career politician who's been through a 10-year leadership development program in their party that is a viable candidate. It's not the person that can raise $1 million out of the gates from high, you know, end donors that's what makes them a valuable candidate. No, it's people with ideas and connections that can make connections with other people that can add to policy and making it real for people. The only way that we're ever going to get the money out of politics is to get more actual people in politics. And so I think everybody should run. I hope that by me being just a mom, you know, running will help to provide some additional inspiration for people who are thinking about it next go around, or even this go around. Still time to jump in.
Well, you are not just a mom. You were a fighter, a boxer, and you have experiences in Japan and foreign policy with senators and whatnot. And even if you were just a mom, no one is quote-unquote just a mom. But most importantly right now, you're a candidate for office. Thank you, Cindy Banier, for joining our podcast. Cindy, let us know your Twitter account. We'll put it up in the link and everything like that so people can see. I appreciate what you're doing.
Absolutely. My website is cindybanier.com. You can email me at vote@cindybanier.com. You can follow me on social media, hashtag Southwest Florida, SWFL Mom 2020. That's my Twitter handle, SWFL Mom 2020. Same thing with Instagram. And you can find me on Facebook as well. So I'm trying to get all over the place. My YouTube channel will be launching shortly, so keep an eye out for that as well.
Well, I just followed you on Twitter, and people are going to be doing that too. I appreciate you running. People, if you're listening, listen to past podcasts. We've got over 40 of them up now. Share them, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, listen to them on your smart device or on Podbean, which is where I share it from. Follow us on Facebook, and I don't really do Twitter on here too much, but thank you. And if you're listening, maybe you should run for office. Thank you, Cindy.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me here.